Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shkwepmekulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Shkwepmek people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. The right to food has been enshrined as an international human right for decades, but the contemporary governance of the global agri-food system significantly challenges the ability of communities and nations to develop concrete strategies that are appropriate for the distinctive institutional, cultural, and environmental contexts. Now, those sobering words were written about a dozen years ago by today's guest, Hannah Whitman, professor in the UBC Faculty of Land and Food Systems. They are the first two sentences of an essay with the blunt and evocative title, Peasant Rights or Food Riots? In this piece, Hannah Whitman compared food security and food sovereignty in Brazil, Guatemala, and Canada. And the essay is centered, and I quote, on the world's 2 billion small-scale and family farmers, indigenous people and fisher folk who produced almost 70% of the food that humans eat on a daily basis. It addresses policies and legislation to enhance food sovereignty, especially in Ecuador, Bolivia, and Brazil, and the challenge that they are faced there and have faced over centuries. Today, we're going to take a hard look at the critical relations between food sovereignty, justice, and the future of the planet and our human community, with someone who has a deep knowledge of all those things. Hannah, we're so happy to have you join us today on Food Conversations.
Great to be here, Dr. Bell.
Please call me Warren. My mother always called me Warren, and my sister did too.
I have deep respect for the medical profession.
Just keep it under control. No, seriously, I always think that I'd like to be at the same level as everybody else rather than up in a pedestal. I'm always taking myself off the pedestal in my office, because especially older folks who come in, they resolutely put you back up there. So
I just age myself.
Yes. No, you didn't. You're a highly trained academic, and I should call you Dr. But I won't.
Students. None of them call me doctor.
No, that's right.
I say that's reserved for the medical profession.
Well, I'll tell all my colleagues. If they want to get some respect, go to Hannah. Anyway, what struck me as I was looking at the stuff you've written is that you must have somewhere along the line become pretty eloquent in Spanish.
Yes, I am fluent in Spanish and also in Portuguese.
Well, there you are. They say that if you learn one, you can learn the other, although you have to swallow things differently in Portuguese, that's for sure. Now, I wanted to make it clear to people that you're a professor, you have all sorts of academic qualifications, but you're quite a down-to-earth person. And I struggled over that phrase, down-to-earth, by the way, you know. food and land and food systems, going a dicey area, But I remember when you were talking, and we were talking about being busy, and you said, yeah, I'm busy. I've got 3 kids and a broken washing machine. That's a great line. I'm going to use that. And the other thing is when you burnt your toast while we were talking, I thought, we're going to be talking at the same level. This is the way things go.
Food first, right?
Absolutely. From the context of food riots, in your title of your paper, I looked up peasant revolts on Wikipedia, and my goodness, there's been an awful lot of times when peasants have said enough already, all over the place. It goes right back to 250 BCE, China, Japan, Southeast Asia, Africa, and of course many in Europe, and the themes were bad weather that wrecked the food supply, incompetence governance. There's a phrase that we could probably dwell on a little bit these days. Disease outbreaks, which of course did the same thing as bad weather, and sometimes they were linked. And then back in the day, narcissistic elites engaged in unnecessary conflict, gratuitous conflict for their own satisfaction. And occasionally there was a religious grounds for it. And the other thing was violent suppression. That was real. I mean, hanging, drawing, and quartering the people who lost was a common thing. Now, today there's less, the repression is less violent, but it's also, it's pretty complete in many respects. There's more negotiation, but kings and aristocracy has been replaced by unspeakably wealthy individuals and corporations, and a mindset that goes along with that. I wonder if you could just muse a little bit on the power structures that are suppressing really well-developed food systems.
Yeah, I think I'll just start by reminding us that violence hasn't gone away. I mean, that's very much a part of our present-day food struggles. Just this winter, some food defenders in Brazil with organizations that I work with were killed by kind of hired gunmen by ranchers. We have violence here in Canada by the RCMP against land defenders and pipeline protests.
Right. So it's
we have violence against harvesters and hunters who, you know, have confrontations with settlers over their land, over the indigenous land that settlers have claimed. So I think we have to remember that violence is absolutely still there, both physical violence, but then also the ongoing political violence and repression of who gets to say about the governance of land. And I think that that has been a thread, you know, going all the way back to the peasant revolts that you've been describing to us, that the struggle over land is a struggle over power. And so when elites argue and fight with each other, they're often fighting over the rights to land and the resources therein, and they often don't think about or care about the people who live from that land, who take care of that land.
And isn't there a structural violence as well that's embedded in the way we've set up systems? I mean, it's not as visible. It's just the Kafkaesque situation where you present your argument and they say, thank you very much, we'll pay attention and listen. And then nothing happens, you know. Mm-hmm. The legislation sits on the shelf, even if it's passed sometimes as well, that kind of thing. We also have another factor that's new, and that is the presence of increasing numbers of extreme weather events. Mm-hmm. Do you want to just talk about that a little bit? Because you've seen it in action in a number of settings where it's really quite devastating.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the kind of some of the food riots when people go hungry from weather. I think of the potato famine in Ireland. A lot of those quote-unquote extreme weather events, the reason that they cause so much damage was because of the insertion of a new food system. So the Irish were only growing potatoes because that was implanted as a crop imported from Peru, actually.
Yes, indeed.
To feed Britain and the empire.
Yes.
And then we had a weather event and there was a disease in the potatoes and they all failed and people went hungry. That was a combination of a weather event and a human-caused structural shift in the food system. Mm-hmm.
And that the British government backed off and refused to help, flatly refused.
Yeah, and that was another piece of the puzzle that then turned into kind of land claims and sort of land, increasing land encroachment into Ireland.
Yeah,
but if you think about the present day and the increasing incidence of extreme weather events and the impact of those. I mean, even just here in British Columbia with the floods that we've had and losing last year's cherry and peach crop because of a late freeze. Again, that was so devastating, partially because we no longer have the diversified food system that would have maybe lost some cherries, but not others.
Right.
Or there would have been other crops to kind of make up the difference or improve the resilience of those farmers not to be so dependent on one crop. And I think the ways in which global trade and sort of the incentives to grow certain crops over others have kind of facilitated farming becoming more homogenous in this province and in many other places of the world.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Has increased the risk of climate disasters in our food system.
And there's this underlying current of monetization of everything. If it doesn't make profit in financial terms, it's not relevant. Interestingly, a connection with the food system, Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen, who own the Cronach Ales just down the road from here, were on the show recently, and they talked about this monetization thing. And it means that when somebody is saying, we'll support what you're doing, they're often thinking about the financial end of things. And that's been a bit of a bugbear for you. Do you want to just talk about some of the recent experiences you've had, which have been very frustrating and diverting?
Well, I mean, monetization is interesting because in the contemporary economy, farmers do need to make money, right? They need to pay their cell phone bill just like we do in the city.
Right.
They need to invest in their equipment. And so the fact that farming in Canada and many of the places in the world isn't economically profitable is a problem.
Yes, agreed, totally.
But we also, I think, need to talk more. I think you and I were talking the other day about the difference between profit and economic viability, right? So is profit reinvested in, are earnings reinvested in the system to strengthen it, to make it more resilient, to pay the bills, and or is profit extracted and invested elsewhere in another economy? And I think what the circular economy or the steady state economy helps us learn about is how do you keep that system running while meeting the needs of the people in it and meeting the needs of the land in it,
yes,
while not kind of extracting for short-term profits, which can often weaken the foundation
of the. And when people come into your life with funds and you know, investment capital, they want impact. They want to see something that is sort of measurable in that mobile profit sort of end of things.
Yeah, we talk a lot now about social impact investing. You know, there's a lot of work that's been done at UBC, even on our own kind of public pension plan.
Right, so indeed.
UBC's pension plan, you know, indirectly, I'll benefit from that when I retire, hopefully. But I want to have a say that they're not investing in extractive industries. And so we actually have the capability now, due to the activism of students.
Yes,
we have the ability to sort of direct our pension funds into semi-safer, when I say safer, I mean ecologically safe, hopefully more socially just. it's not finished. It's not complete. There's still, we don't have total control. But I think there's a lot of awareness now among investors that they do need to have the social license and they do need to show the social impact of their investments. And I think there are people who are very interested in looking at how to quantify that impact in non-financial terms. So is it improving the foundation for society so economies can be more sustainable? Is it investing in open source?
Right.
Software or digital infrastructures that benefit nonprofit entities as well as, you know, businesses. So it's like, how do you actually cross that line? For you have B Corps, for example, you have social
entrepreneurships, sure.
You have new kinds of business that I think are actually really trying to make a difference in the way that they're doing their work.
I'll just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking today with Hannah Whitman, who's a professor in the UBC Faculty of Land and Food Systems. Part of the structural violence that is embedded in the way food systems are intruded upon by various players is the use of IPR, intellectual property rights. And you talked about open source technology, open source ideas, open source systems. The IPR is the antithesis of that, and it's played a huge role in many countries where there are lots of biological resources, biological gifts from Mother Nature, and predatory corporations and nations have come and pounced on that. Do you want to talk about that? Just because you've probably seen some examples that are pretty hair-raising.
So intellectual property rights are an interesting concept because communities who have stewarded and sort of held community held knowledge, that is the intellectual property of those communities.
That's right.
So when we talk about open source, we don't mean that means that everyone should have the access to everyone else's knowledge. And especially that's important with indigenous knowledge and kind of local seed varieties and aspects of knowledge that really are so context specific, and some of which is so sacred that it should not be open source or open.
Thank you for using the word sacred.
Yeah. So that said, there's been a lot of what we call biopiracy, where pharmaceutical companies, agricultural companies, you know, identify a compound, a seed.
Or an entire tree.
Or an entire tree, the neem tree.
Yeah, in India. Yeah.
There's been rice varieties. There's been all kinds of things.
Yes.
And they take that generally to the United States and they patent it and then they start selling it. So that's just theft, first of all. And there have been some really interesting cases where communities have successfully achieved the return of their patent to themselves.
Yes, indeed.
And I think there's
That's what happened with the neem tree.
Yeah, exactly.
Vandana Shiva put her foot down and others, and the Indian Supreme Court actually rejected the application for this patent. But does that happen as often as it should? I don't think it does, but maybe I'm just a cynic.
Not. I think there's, you know, right now there's a lot more being done at kind of the molecular level, and so it's harder to do that. I think also people are less aware of what's happening when a lot of this theft is happening at the molecular level.
Yeah.
The whole kind of world of geoengineering, bioengineering, genetic engineering, CRISPR, the different ways. And there's a lot of, I really have to take it apart. So CRISPR isn't inserting genes from other species. It's snipping genes out of existing species. So is that a patentable process? Not really, not always. So it's a fast moving area, but I think when it comes down and kind of coming back to the food sovereignty question, communities aren't static, right? They want innovation. They want investment. They want to improve seed varieties to be more climate resilient.
If Mozart was alive today, he would have been interested in electronic music.
So it's not so much about, it is about the rights, but it's not, it's about who decides what is done, how, and with what purpose.
Yeah.
And who receives the profits from that.
And isn't, we'll talk about more about indigenous values, but some key values are reciprocity, respect, and being in relationship. And it seems to me that there in that worldview are some answers that speak very eloquently to what we're talking about and how to remedy some of the imbalances there. One of the technologies that I think is very relevant and bears on what you were saying earlier about the intellectual property of a community, which is not registered in a patent, but it is very much the property of that community. And that's agroecology, which has been a theme in your work for a number of years. And it's a theme of food production around the world. It can be considered a form of technology and a form of, there's innovative practices in that world as well. But the difference is that it's communal, it's community centered rather than corporation or profit or you know, individual centered. It's essentially community based. Isn't that a profound difference?
Yeah, I think the agroecology movement really brings together the idea of social technology, ecological responsibility, lots of innovation, but also lots of appropriate sharing of knowledge, both intergenerationally, but also horizontally. Agroecology really depends on farmer-to-farmer knowledge sharings, where people are practicing specific techniques or trying out specific seeds, and they're doing so in a very particular regional, ecological, and economic context. And so therefore, the evidence that they kind of carry on the success or challenges of any given technology are so place-based that they're much more reliable forms of evidence when they're talking to their neighboring farmers than, say, a peer-reviewed paper from some other country about, seed performance in a variety trial. So I think agroecology has a lot to say and a lot to do to support climate resilience specifically because climate change does have such localized effects that are very different, even in the
Exactly.
same region, from different elevations to
Yeah, I was going
different.
to say.
So the agroecological approach is not to homogenize a silver bullet and say this seed is going to save you because it's drought tolerant. It's about which seeds and which context with
Yes.
which field management techniques are the most resilient. And so it's a much more complex and knowledge intensive system compared to conventional agriculture.
And British Columbia is a perfect example of how microclimates and micro ecosystems are everywhere. In our town, we live close to the lake, and it doesn't freeze half as often as it does with patients of mine who are a couple hundred feet higher, and they get snow and have to shovel out their driveways, and I don't. And it's all around the world, and many of the places where we see this kind of situation is, for example, in South America along the Cordillera, the mountain chain that runs from the top of the Mercator projection down to the bottom. When Via Campesina was formed in 1993, agroecology was central to what it was promoting and what it was sustaining and that kind of change. Do you remember when it started up, when Via Campesina kind of came on the scene? It must have had some influence on places you were visiting and the sense of group, collective gathering together.
I was living in Brazil in 2002 to 2004, and I was working with the Landless Workers Movement of Brazil, MST, which was one of the founding members of the Via Campesina. So that's how I came to know about that group. I was invited to their, they have every 4 years a congress, a global congress, which happened to be in Brazil that year. And so I was invited to be a translator at the conference. And so I had, a week of exposure to food sovereignty movements from all over the world. We were in a monastery in southern São Paulo in the winter. I've never been so cold in my
Oh,
life.
really? How cold was it?
Well, it was very cold, and I was living at the time in a different area of Brazil that was very hot, and I didn't have any warm clothes. And we were in a monastery with like very thick stone walls, and it was cold. But it was an incredible opportunity to see, here's people from Palestine, here's people from the United States, here's people from Canada. The National Farmers Union was there. I was rooming with Annette Demaday from the National Farmers Union. She's from Saskatoon.
Yes, a wonderful organization.
Yeah, exactly. So it really sort of was the opportunity to see these are negotiated values, right? This is
Yes,
not one
that's right.
organization saying this is how it's going to be. Do you want to join our struggle? This is really people saying we have some collective values. We have some very diverse contexts and also diverse n needs in their local geographies. And where is that compromise? And so one of the slogans of the Via Campesina is unity in diversity. And I think that's what's been its strength. They've been able to identify those core values that carry the food sovereignty movement forward while supporting groups who are very different. I mean, wheat farmers in Saskatoon are talking to small scale, coffee farmers in Brazil. They have the same
That's right.
struggle
That's
when they
right.
look.
Isn't it interesting that the motto of the United States is in Latin, so nobody knows what it means unless they speak Latin. E pluribus, pluribus unum means exactly the same thing, out of many one, and yet it hasn't happened. I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit now about how women have played such a central role, not just in Via Campesina, but in the whole transformational movement. It's a theme that's coming up all the time. Why don't you talk about that a bit?
We were talking the other day about, people are recognizing more the role of women in agriculture and women in food systems. It's not that our role has changed. It's just maybe being a little bit more noticed.
You're visible now.
Yeah. And not enough. I think that one of the interesting things about the Via Campesina is they had a gender component very early. So there were structural kind of rules, or for lack of a better word, that the organizing committees had to have gender parity. So, and that went all the way from the international coordinating committee to each nation, a coordinating committee of its member organizations, right, all the way down to working in Brazil at the community level. There were family groups that were kind of self-organizing, and those family groups, in any kind of representative meeting, were supposed to have gender parity. And so I think that was interesting for different cultures and different different regions, which had different kinds of gender norms, right, watching that play out. So, for example, in Guatemala, it's very common for men to speak and for women to not speak in meetings. And there was a perception that, well, women are being disempowered. And then I had a student do a bunch of research in Guatemala, and many of the women were like, we speak, we tell the men what to say. So they felt that they had gender parity, and yes, they want to get up in the front. And it was just a very different way of thinking about, yeah, it. And so I think that's been really interesting to see the different ways that different communities have navigated cultural norms, but also, are those cultural norms empowering or disempowering women? And it's really, it's different in different places. And I think there's been more of a recognition of that, and more of opportunities for women who don't feel recognized to take a step forward. And I think the food sovereignty movement has really created a space for that.
And even if they're just invited in the room, you know, the concept, the numerical equivalence is pretty basic, but it doesn't mean that people have to abandon their cultural norms. And just having them in the room, the men would know that the women are there listening to them, making sure they got it right, which would have had an impact, I am quite sure. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Hannah Whitman, who's a professor in the UBC Faculty of Land and Food Systems. The organization PAHO, Pan-American Health Organization, carried out an experiment probably about 40 years ago when I was learning about stuff like this. And they gave $100. It was randomly selected individuals, $100 were given to a woman or to a man. And the behaviors between the men and the women were starkly different. Women spent it on their children, food, clothing, you know, basics. And the men spent it on gambling and booze and you know, easy sex. It was, I remember reading at the time thinking, my goodness, I'm a male, I've got to go around with my head held down if this is what we do when we're in a kind of situation. But it was quite dramatic. And when you put, it's like schools where you have boys segregated from girls, both the boys and the girls start to act silly, and unless their social constraints are limited. But when they're together, it's like you're looking over your shoulder and say, well, I don't want to mess this up, so I can keep my mouth shut a little more often. But you also, when we were talking earlier, you said that women are still, in many settings, marginalized. This idea of having women front and center and equal participants is something that's really challenging in many parts of the world. Why don't you talk about your experiences in that realm?
Well, I'm pretty loud-voiced, so I haven't been like,
no, laughed at. You're from a wealthy.
There are structural dynamics in every place. I mean, in Canada, if you look at leadership in corporations, if you look at leadership at universities, it's overwhelmingly male. If we look at the proportion of women who achieve full professorship, it's disproportionately low.
Yes.
We kind of have to work twice as hard sometimes to get the same amount of recognition. And I think it's not fair. I think there's also the challenge of the perception that if you have kids, then you're not maybe as dedicated to your job as others. There's been quite a few studies, tracking men and women in academia over childbearing years, and women generally aren't promoted as fast or if at all as men. Men are rewarded for parenthood, whereas women are penalized. And so I think those are structural things that we need to address. I think Europe has done better with, more childcare and that sort of thing. BC is doing better with providing $10 a day childcare. I didn't have that when my kids are little. It's amazing. It's, and that's helping, actually.
Yeah, of course. Well, it increases food sovereignty by doing that. When you cover some of these existential, unavoidable costs, it really does make a profound difference. I actually, when I look at the board, when I'm exploring a new organization, I automatically go to the board and I look to see what kind of gender division there is. And I think it's a truism, it's not just my imagination, that organizations that are mostly run by men tend to be narrower. They tend to have less awareness of sort of the human dimension of daily life. They're more oriented around monetization, if I may use that word again twice in the same. But I mean, it's just a way of looking at the world. You can separate the emotion from the reality and deal with it that way. Now,
lots of great feminist men out there. I don't want to turn this into like a man bashing session. You need to think about.
I'm one of them, and I'm quite happy being a male.
Yeah. But there's lots of research showing that having more diversity on boards, and by diversity, we're not just talking about gender diversity.
Right.
We're also talking about people of color, ableism. That really can strengthen an organization because you have more points of view to assess risks and opportunities. And there's just study after study that shows that your organization will be more stable, more innovative, more resilient to risk when you have diversity, not only on your board, but in your workforce. And so I think that's why it's so disappointing to see all the stuff that's happening in the U.S. right now of the gutting of all of those policies that are evidence-based to show to strengthen organizations. And because of ideology, they're just being wiped out. So I think it's weakening a lot of progress that was made.
Science. Let's use the data we have in hand. We don't need to even pile up more. We've got a lot already that tells us what to do. Let's talk a little bit about something a little bit closer to home, and that's the UBC Farm. Because it's an institution that, in a way, has embodied some of the evolutionary change that have taken place over time in understanding of food, relationship to food, what kind of research you do with food. Why don't you describe, because you know this institution intimately, why don't you describe a little bit of its sort of evolution from being indigenous land at one point, pure and simple, to going through the endowment process, et cetera, and where does it come to today?
Yeah, so I had the privilege of serving as the director of the UBC Farm from 2015 to 2021. It was one of the reasons I wanted to work at UBC.
I want a farm.
Well, it wasn't that I wanted to farm. I saw it as a living lab where we can actually look really the entirety of the food system in this one location. And so if you look at the history of the land, so this is Musqueam land, it's on the high bank. It's where Musqueam had learning activities for generations upon generations. There was hunting there. There was gathering of foods, lots of forest. And so it was a really sacred and special place.
Yes.
It was eventually, stolen and put into the university endowment lands when UBC was created. And UBC always had a farm. So they imported... I was telling you the other day.
Oh, Scottish, I know. This is amazing.
From Scotland, along with a Scottish farmer to take care of them. And they started inscribing a Western European colonial system onto that landscape. So that meant food planted in rows. That meant, research on productivity, research on... There was some nice animal health, animal welfare research going on.
Hmm.
But there was kind of the traditional North American model of which crops grow the best, the fastest, and for the most money.
Yes.
As was the case with many, many campus farms. This isn't unique.
Oh, yes. Nothing new.
Yeah. So they chugged along and had their research and landed the Faculty of Agriculture, which as it was known at the time, was one of the founding faculties of UBC.
Indeed. And then the corporate world decided to want to intrude.
Agriculture research evolved. A lot of it went into the laboratory. There wasn't as much interest in field trials. The UBC farm has very unique soils. They're very different than the soils of the Fraser Valley or the Kootenays or the Okanagan. And so when we were talking about the place-based knowledge of agroecology, the variety trials and different kinds of trials that were happening at UBC Farm were not like the soils and environmental, even the microclimate of the main agricultural producing regions of BC. So it became perceived as less useful as a demonstration farm because the ecological context was so different. So it was kind of abandoned. It was put into the housing reserve to build condos on the endowment lands to, you know, support education because we were not getting enough support for education from the provincial government. I think BC still is among the lowest in all of Canada in support for education as a proportion of our GDP. Some students kind of found some fields out there and started growing vegetables. A couple of them lived out there in trailers, and they started growing vegetables and selling to the local neighborhoods kind of as a learning project. Right. There was Derek Semelink, who is now an agrologist with the BC Ministry of Agriculture. He wrote a master's thesis, I think, in the mid-90s, kind of envisioning the UBC farm as an agroecological learning space, as a place to think about systems more broadly. It was quite radical at the time.
I remember hearing about having people who are in very disadvantaged circumstances being brought to the farm to work the land under, you know, guidance from staff. And it was a very powerful program in terms of bringing about healing in people who were marginalized and, you know, didn't have this sense that they were part of this, the web of life, as it were, but also the social web of life. At one point, it was also supplying food for a number of the university residences, restaurants. I actually ate some of the food at part of a conference that took place in Richmond because we were all invited out to see how good. It was absolutely wonderful food, and the students were just wild about it. I mean, the ones who were studying, you know, they couldn't wait to come back and eat it in their restaurants, which is not what you do in institutions most of the time, certainly not hospitals. we're terrible that way. We're getting better, but we're terrible.
Yeah. You might actually be interested in talking to Ned Bell. He's a chef in Vancouver that's done a project with the Vancouver General Hospital to improve the hospital diets with all new recipes. Yes. It's actually going quite well.
Yes, indeed. Oh, you know, the thing is that the people who like it are the people who are being served by the institution. The people who don't like it are the people who are bean counters looking at, okay, it's a little bit more expensive, or it's a little bit, you know, the delivery of food is a little bit less reliable in the way of it's always there every day, but the quality of the food is superb. I mean, it just comes bursting out of the ground and straight into the pot, and that's a very good way to do it. But there was this process where there was a huge debate, and in the end, the university had so much pushback from the community. I remember Erica Frank, who's been involved with CAPE for a number of years. She was one of the protagonists there. And the university finally said, okay, well, we're going to keep it as a farm. Do you think it's still got that role that it once had, or is it being truncated, or how's it doing, in your opinion?
I think the UBC farm is still a leader. It does. We have a new director, Dr. Sean Smuckler. We have a new kind of strategic plan that's really focused on actionable research. I think we're advancing a lot in the living lab category, where we're not trying to say that the farm is representative of any other landscape, but we're trialing a lot of technologies. We're trialing open source software. Right. We're doing variety trials. We're doing lots of greenhouse gas assessment and developing new methodologies for farmers to be able to calculate their carbon footprint. And then there's all of the students that are coming through the farm, you know, even as a class visit, or there's classes that are held at the farm. I think it does have that amazing ability to bring theory into reality for students, having that space. And then there's also the community programs that are still happening there. So you mentioned, you know, since the late 90s, I think Farm Folk, City Folk started a project where they brought a group of Mayan refugees, a group of people from Taiwan, and I think a group of people from from Ukraine or so, I think. And the Mayans are still there. So
Oh,
these were sort
really?
of, yeah, they had this intercultural exchange program where these, kind of social groups who had come to Vancouver and who were didn't have a place to kind of practice their agrarian culture. They were sort of given an opportunity to do that at the UBC farm and to exchange with students. So the Mayans are still there. We
That's
also
lovely.
have Musqueam have a garden and space. There's some spiritual and cultural space there, managed by the Wet'suwet'en Garden and their staff. There's a culturally relevant urban wellness program that brings youth to the space to do, cultural and ecological activities, wellness
Sure.
activities. So there's just a lot of community there where different organizations are kind of coexisting. It's not always without tension. We had the logging sports club at the farm for a while that were not respecting the land, and there's been some tension around that, but there's also been a lot of learning for the
For sure,
students
yes.
why this behavior is not appropriate. And so I think
The
that's exciting to see, even getting the forestry faculty involved, getting the education faculty involved. It's been a real place for even an interdisciplinary engagement for us as faculty to see what we can learn from other programs.
get out in the field and get your hands dirty, get down on your knees and deal with the land. Remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Hannah Whitman, who's professor in the UBC Faculty of Land and Food Systems. Now, one of the things that the UBC Farm does is it gathers evidence, as many other institutions do, which can be used to develop policies. So I'm going to use the P word because I think it's really important. You use this phrase, going from being a movement to being a policy. And that transition is sort of like etching in stone what has been everybody's heart and mind, and maybe in the research documents that they've prepared or the discourses they've had with one another. Why don't you talk about that critical transition from a lot of people saying this is a really good idea, and then, as it were, drawing up a formal, laying out a formal approach that's based on all of that input and how powerful that can be.
Yeah, a really good example are food policy councils, which have definitely emerged in Canada and even recently at the national level. But that's something that really has come out of the food sovereignty movement. So Brazil had one of the first national food policy councils, which brought together farmers, nutritionists, educators, public health people to say, look, we need a food policy that actually serves not just growers, but also eaters. And so Brazil developed a national zero hunger food policy that had all kinds of different programs. They had wage subsidies, there were food banks and food hubs, there were low-cost public restaurants in low-income areas, there were an augmentation to school food programs to connect them more easily with local small-scale farmers. There were price premiums given for organic or agroecological certified production. And then all the way up to, looking at investing in the food system, there was a lot of investment in food processing facilities. There were subsidies for women farmers. There were youth training programs. So they really took a holistic policy approach to moving the dial on the food system, and it had incredible results. So this was kind of the 2004 to 2015 kind of phase where you saw food security really rise, you saw incomes rise, you saw the cost of food go down. So you saw an improvement in public health in that period. And then there was a period of political
Unrest.
change in Brazil, a coup. And some of those policies were dismantled, but not all of them. And so I think that's the nice thing about when you have a movement that manages to legislate stuff that makes sense, it's a little bit harder to dismantle.
A good idea is something that changes the world. I think many people have said that and believed it, and they've seen evidence of it as well. Now, we should also let the world know that you had your chops right from the beginning. You grew up on a mixed crop and cattle ranch. Today, what you're doing, I'm sure, has some some point of origin in that world that you grew up in. Why don't you talk about the land and what your relationship was to it when you were growing up as a kid?
Yeah, so I grew up in a very remote area. It was, 8 miles to a paved road and 4 miles to the next house, which was my cousin. So we had a big family and did a lot of work together as a family. It wasn't always very fun. So
work. I was you have a chore.
Get out of here. I didn't mind working. I just didn't necessarily want to be doing that kind of work. So, and I was the oldest of my generation, and farming was very hard in the '80s.
Yeah,
there wasn't a lot of money. There was a lot of people failing in their farms. My family worked very hard, and also had a lot of privilege in the sense that they occupied this land, they inherited it over several generations. But I didn't really understand all that at that time.
It was just way you lived.
The way you lived. And so I moved to the city. I got interested in international development and got assigned. I really wanted to travel, had no money. And so I joined the Peace Corps in an agricultural program because I had the skills.
Paraguay. Is that where you learned Spanish?
Well, I learned Spanish in college, and where I was placed in Paraguay was a community that only spoke an indigenous language called Guarani.
Okay.
So my Spanish was useless. I did actually learn Guarani. I don't speak it anymore. It's been too long. But I speak a few words here and there. So that was a learning experience that I had to learn to communicate again in a third language. And it was mainly the children that taught me the language because they weren't shy about correcting me when I was wrong, whereas a lot of the community members were a little shy about this foreigner coming to live with them. And
you're staying here, you got to learn the language. Sorry, that's all there is to it.
Yeah, very remote again, no electricity, no running water. So I lived in a little house for 2 years with dirt floor and a thatch roof. And
but you weren't intimidated by that because you'd seen what it's like to live on the land and be far away from the facilities we consider sometimes necessary. They're not.
Yeah. Probably why I was sent there, because I could handle it. But yeah, it was fun. It was, again, it was figuring out that the struggles of these farmers were not different than the struggles of my family. So they were growing a lot of cotton at the time. Cotton prices had tanked, using a lot of pesticides and herbicides that were very expensive. And so we were sort of part of a program that was shifting to more agroforestry and vegetable production for local markets. We started a farmer's market. We actually created a health post, which was what they were really interested in. And then the second year we worked on farmer's markets. But yeah, it was a chance to kind of be a community organizer and to try to understand, we can't just come in from the outside with our ideas. We have to learn what it is that people need, work together with them to achieve those goals.
And that worked for you and for them. I mean, you kind of became, as much as you could be, a bit of a unit.
Yeah, I think it was, you have to be willing to listen. So I was sent there as part of an agroforestry program, and I was supposed to be, quote unquote, teaching people how to plant trees. And it became pretty clear to me, hey, people already know how to plant trees. And they're not interested in that because they don't have space to do it.
Yes.
And what they really wanted was a health post because there was no medical services. And so we did some thinking and talking and ended up applying for a grant, which was money to buy some bricks. And we did some trips to the Ministry of Health. And they said, well, if you build the building, we'll send a doctor. And so then over a period of a year, we got all of the wood donated by community members. Mm-hmm. We had all the labor donated. And the grant was enough to pay for the bricks and the roof and the tile for the floor. And did pay one guy to be the stone person.
Yes.
And by the end of the year, we had a health post. It was very simple. It was four walls and a roof, but it was had a tile floor and had a sink. And
it didn't have to be fancy. It had to be functional. And that was what really counted.
And then people were like, well, you're here for another year. What was it that you wanted to talk about again about trees? So we started a little demonstration farm of an agroforestry system that was kind of helpful to reduce soil erosion. They were able to sort of plant some fruits and vegetables underneath of it. We started a farmer's market, so they had a place to sell those fruits and vegetables. And it started kind of a slow transition to be able to fill the gap where cotton was kind of not providing any income and actually putting them more in debt. So
Well,
it was really interesting to see that transition.
and they would have known a lot. You weren't having to teach them. You just encouraged them and supported them and said, "Yeah, I'll do what I can to help." It's interesting the transition between your first degree, which was environmental studies, and a BA, and international development, and then the next two degrees included development and sociology. Now, not everybody who studies in the world of agriculture and growing food thinks in terms of the sociology of the subject. But obviously, you were struck by what you were learning, and you saw kind of the social matrix in which events take place. It's just as important as what you're actually doing. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, so I think that it's all about the social organization. You know, there's plenty of technology in the world, there's plenty of solutions, there's actually plenty of money, but we don't have the social structure that enables that to thrive. And so looking at how farmers organize, how communities organize, looking at how that organization translates into political structures, it's really important. And so that, I think, is what has always drawn me to work in the food system as an organizer and as someone who kind of can pull together the different threads. So a lot of my research projects, we're pulling people in from soil science, ecology, nutrition, and looking at how those ideas and approaches actually really need to work together if we're going to come to any kind of viable food system solution. So I really love that part of it. I love collective action. I love thinking about the commons and how we c recreate new commons in the world that we live in that's always trying to privatize care apart.
Oh dear, yes, isn't that a huge dichotomy that keeps on cropping up? And there are cultural norms, for example, in the colonial nations that say individualism, you know, this kind of liberty for the individual. It's actually the antithesis of successful group functioning. Everybody's got a place, but they don't have to be, it doesn't have to be the only place. And I sense that that's what really made the project, this particular project and others you worked on, go be so successful, this multidisciplinary approach. Agroecology, a paper you just, its latest paper on your UBC, your personal homepage, you quoted the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization from the UN. And as you said this, agroecology is an approach to food systems development that is tightly integrated with food sovereignty principles, aiming to optimize the interactions between plants, animals, humans, and the environment, while also addressing the need for socially equitable food systems within which people can exercise choice over what they eat and how and where it is produced. That sounds like something that could have come out of a speech by Chief Dan George. You know, it's got all those elements of the humans in the landscape, as opposed to being seen as the threat in the landscape. We are part of the shaping factors that can make a huge difference. Does that seem about right for you?
Yeah, I think kind of what Western culture tried to do and hasn't done successfully is separate humans from nature to create this perceived dualism that humans are not part of nature and therefore we have the right to dominate it. And I think what agroecology does and the food sovereignty world kind of goes back to those, you know, they are indigenous principles, but they're indigenous principles that are from the land all over the world that humans are part of nature. We are part of nature and we have a responsibility to it just as we have a relationality to it, and we then benefit from that relationship, right? If we don't take care of the land, it can't take care of us.
Well, as a physician, one of the things that unites everybody is the fact that when you're cut, you bleed red blood, and nobody has a different color, and all the organs in your body are, especially in the embryo stage of the embryo, we go through all sorts of transitions from other species that are really quite revealing of our connectedness to the rest of the world. It's been a real delight to have you on the show, Hannah, and maybe one day we'll have you back and we can talk about, for example, some of the indigenous practices that you are fostering and involved with as well. But I think it's no surprise that some of your students who've been on Food Conversations have spoken very highly of you and your openness and your willingness to work with people and explore ideas with people and not, raise dogmatism and other kinds of unpleasant things. Thank you very much for being on the show today and look toward seeing you again.
Thanks for having me, Lauren.